past Jones into the water.
"Do you see that big rock?" she asked. "I do. It's low tide now. You can see it. Most times it's under water. About 5 feet out from that rock, there's a big hole. The water's not so deep there, but the redfish group up in it when the tide's running hard. My boys took many a meal out of that old hole. Nobody knows about it now, boats running all around, but I still see those big old red drums sticking their tails up, rooting around the bottom for crabs and shrimp. Boats don't ever stop, though."
"You mentioned children," Jones said. "I assume they're grown and away. Do they visit often?"
"As much as they can. I don't expect them to, really." She turned as if amazed. "Did you know every one of my children has grandchildren?" "I never thought I'd be so old," Willow said. "Don't know when it happened. Probably when Brad died. Brad was my baby," she explained. "Not really a baby, almost 50, but still."
Both were silent for a bit before Willow spoke again.
"It didn't hit me so hard when Bobby Gray passed. But a mama ought not outlive her children. Seems a cruel thing."
Willow's lip quivered and her voice broke.
"I have outlived my usefulness. How in the world did I get so old?"
She sniffed hard, then stuck her chin in the air.
"Listen to me," she said. "Going on like a crazy person. I apologize. You must think I'm terribly rude."
"No, no," Jones said gently. "Not at all. I do not think you rude in the least. Wrong, maybe, but certainly not rude."
Willow turned sharply, not sure she had heard correctly.
"I beg your pardon?"
Jones smiled and chose his words carefully.
"My dear lady, I would banish from the realm of possibility that you would ever be rude. However," Jones held a finger in the air, "when you make a statement so patently ridiculous as, 'I have outlived my usefulness,'" he shrugged, "I fear I must openly disagree."
Willow turned and looked back at the water.
"You are kind to say so," she said.
"But you don't believe me?"
Jones asked, knowing the answer. Willow was too polite to stand up and walk away, or even to suggest he mind his own business. But for goodness sake, she was aghast that a man she did not even know possessed the gall to dispute her conclusions about her own life. Then to press the matter.
"Sir," she said, a bit flustered, "I am an old woman wishing merely to live out my days without being in the way of those who still have much to do."
Jones raised his arms and looked upward.
"Oh, Lord," he said, "don't let this old person die on this bench beside me."
Holding the pose, he peered at Willow from the corners of his eyes.
"Don't tease," she said, and he chuckled softly.
"Well, then," Jones said, "you be serious. You aren't that old." "How old do you think I am?"
Jones paused as she looked at him.
"Come on now, think about it. Look me over. How old do you think I am?"
"I have no idea," Willow said.
"Well, then," Jones said good-humoredly, "you're a winner, for sure, because I haven't got any idea either."
They both laughed, then Jones added,
"I quit counting on the 50th anniversary of my 39th birthday."
Willow shook her head.
"Do you really not know?"
"Oh, I'm sure I could call it within a couple of decades," Jones said, "but what's the point? Should we let a number dictate how we feel? Besides, young lady, and I do consider you a young lady, who gave you permission to decide that you had nothing more to do, nothing more to offer?"
"Well," Willow said, "that is just an honest look at things. After Bobby passed away, and with the children living lives of their own—"
Willow trailed off, but then, as if trying to convince herself, and with an air of finality,
"there is only so much bridge one can play, and after all, isn't it the duty of the old to make way for the young? I simply feel that my time has passed."
"Woo-wee!" Jones said in a high-pitched voice as he slapped his knees with both hands. "And aren't we glad everybody doesn't feel that way? The world would surely have missed out on some grand achievements."
"Mr. Jones," Willow said, trying not to smile, "you are teasing again."
"Well, I am and I ain't," he countered. "And it's just Jones. But let me give you a different perspective about that feeling that your time has passed. Isn't it a good thing Harlan Sanders didn't retire when he turned 65?
The name didn't register with Willow.
"Harlan Sanders?"
"You probably remember him as Colonel Sanders. But it wasn't until he was 65 that he took a family recipe and began franchising restaurants to serve his fried chicken. And all he had at the time was his Social Security checks to get started. $105 a month."
"I didn't know that," Willow said. 65, was he? Pretty good for a young person."
Jones chuckled.
"I thought you might see it that way. Well, what about Benjamin Franklin? He didn't invent bifocals until he was 78. Winston Churchill was also 78 and finished with more than a couple of careers when he wrote a book that won the Nobel Prize for Literature. Want me to continue?"
Then, without so much as another breath, he said,
"Nelson Mandela was inaugurated president of South Africa for the first time after years in that country's prisons, at the age of 75. Igor Stravinsky was still doing concerts when he was 87. Grandma Moses, the artist, did not sell her first painting until she was 90. Michelangelo didn't begin his work on St. Peter's Basilica, one of the world's greatest treasures, until he was 72.
"Stop," Willow ordered, throwing up a hand and trying her best to stifle a smile. "How long could you go on with a list like this?
How much time do you have?"
"I suppose that's what we've been talking about," Willow replied. "How much time I have."
Frowning suddenly, she said,
"Only..."
"Only what?"
Jones prompted.
"Only I seem to have come to a lonely, fearful place. I've lived quite a few years myself, you know, and trying not to make more of it than it is, this is the worst time in my life."
"Would you like logical proof that things will get better?"
Jones asked.
"Oh, come on," Willow scoffed. "Does proof like that really exist?"
"Of course it does," Jones answered earnestly. "Many of life's treasures remain hidden from us simply because we never search for them. Often we do not ask the proper questions that might lead us to the answer to all our challenges. We are so caught up in fear and regret that hope seems a foolish endeavor. Proof of hope, however, is not only possible, it is an overlooked law of the universe."
"Okay," Willow relented. "You have my attention."
"First," Jones began, looking down at his weather-beaten hands, "even during trying times, it is important to understand that such times are a normal part of life's ebb and flow. Nothing to be too alarmed about. After all, every one of us is always in a crisis, coming out of a crisis, or headed for a crisis. Crisis? That's just part of being with us on this planet."
Then, suddenly turning to face her, Jones said,
"Take a deep breath."
"Excuse me?" she said.
"Come on now, a big one. A big, deep breath."
As Willow's shoulders rose and then fell, she looked at Jones questioningly.
"What does that tell you?" he said when she had exhaled.
"Well, that the air is clean."
"No, no," Jones said enthusiastically. "More basic. Give me a literal view. What is the fundamental thing we know about a person who can breathe?"
"That they are alive?"
"Correct," Jones exulted. "That they are alive. Therefore, what might we ascertain from the fact that you can breathe?"
"That I am alive?"
Willow said, a bit more certain this time of her answer.
"That is correct," Jones said. "And with that realization, we have the beginning of a chain of simple, unvarnished truths about your existence on this earth. Your very breath provides authentic and infallible absolutes that cannot be disputed. Here, my friend, even during what you may consider the worst time in your life is proof of hope. Incidentally, this proof is genuine regardless of a person's age, physical condition, financial situation, color, gender, emotional state of belief. Now, listen closely. If you are breathing, you are still alive. If you are alive, then you are still here, physically, on this planet.
If you are still here, then you have not completed what you were put on earth to do. If you have not completed what you were put on earth to do, then your very purpose has not yet been fulfilled. If your purpose has not yet been fulfilled, then the most important part of your life has not yet been lived. And if the most important part of your life has not yet been lived, Jones paused, waiting for Willow to follow his thoughts to conclusion. That is my proof of hope, Willow said softly. Yes, it is, Jones agreed. If the most important part of your life is ahead of you, then even during the worst times, one can be assured that there is more laughter ahead, more success to look forward to, more children to teach and help, more friends to touch and influence. There is proof of hope for more. They were silent for a time before Willow spoke again. Where do I begin? How do I start? She said quietly. Don't misunderstand me, Jones. I am old, but I am not hard-headed. I am convinced, she smiled shyly, and excited. I'd like to accomplish something, even though I know it won't be a big thing. It would be nice to know that I'm at least making a tiny difference. Jones pursed his lips and looked at Willow warily. How would you react, he said, if I disagreed with you twice in one day? Taken by surprise, the old woman opened her eyes wide. What did I say this time? She asked in disbelief. Jones took a breath and blew it out noisily. Shaking his head, he said, That part about a tiny difference? Yes. What was wrong with that? Surely I can make a tiny difference. Shaking his head, Jones said, Sorry, I've never known a single person who ever made a tiny difference. I am not even convinced it is possible. So you will have to settle for making a huge difference. Intrigued, Willow cocked her head. Go on. While it is true that most people never see or imagine the difference they make, or sometimes only imagine their actions having a tiny effect, every single action a person takes has far-reaching consequences. A moment ago, you and I were talking about particular people who had accomplished great things during the later years of their lives. Do you know the name Norman Borlaug? Willow shook her head. Norman Borlaug was 91 when he was informed that he had been personally responsible for saving the lives of 2 billion people. 2 billion people? Willow exclaimed. How is that possible? Norman Borlaug was the man who hybridized corn and wheat for arid climates, Jones answered. The Nobel Committee, the Fulbright scholars, and many other experts calculated that all across the world, in Central and South America, Western Africa, across Europe and Asia, throughout the plains of Siberia, and America's own desert southwest, Borlaug's work has saved from famine over 2 billion people, and the number is increasing every day. Incredible, Willow said. Yes, Jones agreed, isn't it? But the most incredible part of the story is that Borlaug, for all the credit he has received... Jones glanced around as if to prevent someone from hearing what he was about to say. For all the credit he has received, Borlaug was not the person who saved the 2 billion people. What? That's right, Jones confirmed. I believe it was a man named Henry Wallace. He was vice president of the United States under Roosevelt. I thought Truman was vice president under Roosevelt, Willow said suspiciously. He was, Jones agreed. But remember, Roosevelt served 4 terms. His first 2 terms, John Nance served as vice president. His 4th term, Truman. But it was during Roosevelt's 3rd term that his vice president was a former secretary of agriculture named Henry Wallace. While Wallace was Vice President of the United States, he used the power of his office to create a station in Mexico, whose sole purpose was to somehow hybridize corn and wheat for arid climates. And he hired a young man named Norman Borlaug to run it. So while Norman Borlaug won the Nobel Prize, it was really Henry Wallace, whose initial act was responsible for saving the 2 billion lives. "'I never knew,' Willow said. "'Why, I don't even remember the man.'
"'That's okay,' Jones replied. "'Now that I think about it, maybe it wasn't Henry Wallace who should have gotten credit anyway.'
Willow appeared startled. "'Now, why would you say that?' she asked. Jones dropped his eyes to the ground and rubbed his chin, as if deep in thought.
"'Maybe it was George Washington Carver who saved the 2 billion lives.'
Then his head popping up again, he said, "'You remember him, don't you?'
"'Yes,' Willow answered quickly. "'Peanuts. But what does he—' "'What people don't know about George Washington Carver is that while he was 19 and a student at Iowa State University, he had a dairy sciences professor who allowed his own 6-year-old boy to go on botanical expeditions every weekend with this brilliant student. George Washington Carver took that little tot and directed his life. And it was Carver who gave this 6-year-old Henry Wallace a vision about his future and what he could do with plants to help humanity.
Jones shook his head in wonder.
"'It is amazing, isn't it?' he said, "'that Carver could spend all that time with the peanut. Hours and months and years of work. I mean, the man developed 266 products from the peanut that we still use today. And then there's this sweet potato, 88 uses he developed from it.
Jones leaned forward, hands on his knees.
He also wrote an agricultural tract and promoted the idea of what he called a victory garden.
Willow smiled.
I remember victory gardens. We had one.
Yes, so did most people, Jones said. Victory gardens, even in the middle of major cities, fed a significant portion of our population during World War II.
But with all the time and effort and years that Carver spent on things like peanuts and sweet potatoes and victory gardens, isn't it amazing that a few afternoons with a 6-year-old boy named Henry Wallace turned out to make that much of a difference?
Truly, Willow said with awe in her voice, so it was George Washington Carver whose actions saved all those people.
Ah, Jones shook his head. Not really.
What?
It had to have been the farmer from Diamond, Missouri. Jones grinned as Willow threw up her hands. There was a farmer in Diamond, Missouri named Moses, Jones continued, who had a wife named Susan. They lived in a slave state but didn't believe in slavery. Well, that was a problem for those crazy people who rode through farms at night, terrorizing what they called sympathizers, and one cold winter night, Quantrill's raiders attacked Moses and Susan's farm. They burned the barn, shot several people, and dragged off a woman named Mary Washington, who refused to let go of her infant son, George. Now, Mary Washington was Susan's best friend, so Moses sent word out immediately, trying to arrange a meeting with those cutthroats, trying to do something to get Mary and her baby back. Within a few days he had the meeting set, and so, on a January night, Moses took a black horse and went several hours north to a crossroads in Kansas. There he met 4 of Quantrill's men, who arrived on horseback carrying torches, wearing flour sacks with eye-holes cut out over their heads. And Moses traded the only horse he had left on his farm for what they threw him in a burlap bag. As they thundered off, Moses fell to his knees. There in the freezing dark, with his breath's vapor blowing hard and white from his mouth, Moses brought out of that burlap bag a cold, naked, almost dead baby boy. And he opened up his jacket, and he opened up his shirts, and he placed that baby next to his skin. Moses fastened that child in under his clothes and walked that baby out, talking to that child every step of the way, telling the baby he would take care of him and raise him as his own, promising to educate him, to honor Mary, his mother, who they knew was already dead.
Jones looked intently at Willow, who stared back in wonder.
That was the night, he said softly, that the farmer told that baby he would give him his name. And that is how Moses and Susan Carver came to raise that little baby, George Washington.
So there. It was obviously the farmer from Diamond, Missouri, who saved the 2 billion people. They sat quietly for a moment, until Jones raised his finger as if an idea had come to him. Teasing, he said, "Unless, maybe..." But then, seeing the tears in Willow's eyes, he said, "So you see, madam, we could continue this line of reasoning all evening. For the truth is, who knows who it really was whose single action saved the 2 billion people? How far back could we go?" Jones reached over and took Willow's hand. "And how far into the future could we go, dear lady, to show how many lives you will touch? There are generations yet unborn whose very lives will be shifted and shaped by the moves you make and the actions you take tonight and tomorrow and tomorrow night and the next day and the next. No matter your age, physical condition, financial situation, color, gender, emotional state or belief, everything you do, every move you make, matters to all of us. And forever." "Thank you," Willow said faintly. "Thank you." "And thank you, young lady," Jones said as he stood. "Thank you for the opportunity to spend a few moments with you and rest in such a beautiful spot." He began walking slowly westward toward the canal. "Let's not rest too long, though," Willow heard him say as the evening darkness took him from her sight. "Time is precious, and you have much to do."
Chapter 7. My boys climbed into my lap. The 6-year-old spoke first.
"Mr. Jones sure is nice."
"He is, isn't he?" I responded.
Jones had left only minutes earlier, having spent the evening with Polly, the boys, and me, and as always declining our invitation to stay the night.
"I love Mr. Jones," said our 4-year-old.
"I do too, buddy," I replied.
"Hey, did you guys call him Jones or Mr. Jones?"
"Mr. Jones," they both answered solemnly. Then our oldest added, "He said we could call him just plain Jones, but I told him we might get in trouble if we didn't say Mr. for somebody that old."
I silently gave thanks that Jones was not a woman.
"What did he say to that?" I asked.
"He just laughed," my toddler answered. "Then he kind of scruffled our hair and bumped our heads together. Real soft, though. It didn't hurt."
I was grateful that my family had at last been able to meet the old man. He had been in town for almost 6 weeks, and I was beginning to despair that I might not have any more time alone with him. 3 or 4 cups of coffee, always unexpectedly or on the spur of the moment, were the only encounters it seemed we would have. Then, of course, there was the treehouse. I was the first one of my family to be up and around that morning. As I left the kitchen door to make the brief outdoor walk to my office, I stopped and literally rubbed my eyes in disbelief. There, perched in the 6 palm trees beside our home, was a treehouse that had not been there the afternoon before. Suffice it to say, I was stunned. Trust me, this was no ordinary treehouse. The construction looked like something straight out of Swiss Family Robinson and had not the slightest relation to the plywood platforms I had nailed precariously to the branches of the nearest oak when I was a boy. In fact, there didn't seem to be a nail in the entire structure. Bamboo, rope, and thatch appeared to be woven seamlessly into what can only be described as a child's dream home. As I stood there with my mouth open, Jones stuck his head through the treehouse doorway. Grinning broadly, he said, "Join me," and extended a hand to guide me up the ladder.
"Do you think they'll like it?"
"Who?" I asked dumbly.
"Your boys," Jones laughed. "Will they like it?"
Reaching the tiny porch, I said,
"My gosh, they'll love it. How did you do this? When did you do this?" "Oh, I had plenty of time," he chuckled, "and Claire and Scott helped me. AmazuluInc.com had all the materials. You've heard of the Internet?"
I peered at him suspiciously, and he laughed so hard that I thought he might fall off the tree.
"Remember, Andy," he finally said, "you can do whatever you want to do. You can accomplish whatever you want to accomplish. You are never lacking funds. Neither is the calendar your enemy. When you need most to accomplish something great in your life, you are only lacking an idea. Time and money, my friend, are also a matter of perspective."
Anyway, I never did find out how he did it. Claire and Scott, I learned later, worked with AmazuluInc.com, a company that imports unusual materials for companies like Disney or SeaWorld, but they both swore they were nowhere around that night and had not even heard of a client named Jones. The boys, as you might imagine, did love the treehouse. They still play in it every day. About that time, I was also increasingly aware of just how strange it seemed to hear stories about Jones sightings from people in the area who didn't even know we were acquainted. He was beginning to create quite a stir. Almost everywhere he appeared, because of his reputation for honesty and wisdom dispensed with a healthy dose of humor, a crowd would gather to ask questions and listen closely to his answers. Everyone seemed to emerge from those encounters with a new perspective on their situation, which allowed them to regroup, take a breath, and begin their lives again from a different point of view. We also heard about individuals who managed to talk with him one-on-one. Most of these conversations, it seemed, were almost eerie in the coincidence of place and time that brought Jones into each person's life. The stories reminded me of my first encounter with him that night under the pier so long ago. Earlier in the day, I had passed a business on the beach that displayed a huge sign. In the largest letters available, the owner had placed a quote from Jones for everyone to see. The old man had spoken the words during a conversation with several people about the hurricane devastation suffered by the Gulf Coast over the past several years. A friend had already told me what he said, and folks around here were repeating it to one another, but to see Jones' words on the huge sign seemed amazing. It read, "Rebuild with a grateful heart. You may have lost a house, but you did not lose your home. Remember, you are still breathing. Jones." I laughed when I heard he had been to a local church, I won't say which one, and when the pastor asked if there were any prayer requests, Jones stood up and said, "I'd like us to pray for some smiling faces in this church." Then in typical fashion, he added, "I think more people would want to go to heaven if they weren't afraid it'd be like church when they got there." It was amazing, really. Jones merely told the truth, and without exception, people accepted what he said with open minds and good humor. Even the hardest hearts seemed to melt in his presence. Henry Warren left Atlanta just after midnight, headed for the coast. He drove through Montgomery with no radio or CD playing. In silence, just before 5 o'clock, he took the first Baymanette exit off I-65 and turned south on Highway 59 toward the beach. Henry was 32 years old and married to a wife he rarely saw, who was pregnant with their first child. They lived in Buckhead, a suburb of Atlanta, in a townhome they struggled to afford, this in addition to a 2-bedroom condo on the beach. Financially, Henry was nowhere near where he wanted to be, and even though he was a big-picture guy and a tireless worker, sometimes he wondered if he was beating his head against the wall and didn't know it. There was not enough time to go by his own place, but he had a few minutes to rest before meeting both crews at the new condominium job he had recently bid for and won. And it was a job that would take both crews, he knew. Henry had promised the developer that all palms, shrubs, flowering plants, sod, and irrigation would be in place and complete within 6 days. It was a massive undertaking, and one he knew there was no chance of finishing on time. But at that point, he reasoned, the job was already his, and the developer would have no choice but to let him finish. As Henry slid the Tahoe into a parking place and cut off the engine, he mentally debated whether to sleep for a few minutes or work on the bid for another project due later that day. Before reaching a conclusion, Henry fell into a fitful sleep. Henry's business life was a juggling act. He never did anything overtly illegal, as long as one didn't count the undocumented workers,
but a graduate course in ethics could have written a curriculum based on the corners Henry cut on a daily basis. There would always be plenty of work, though, he reasoned, for the person who kept his eye on the big picture. The big picture for Henry involved signing contracts with as many clients as he could possibly sign. And to get them, he promised timetables that could never be met, materials he would never actually use, and quality he would never deliver. His modus operandi was simply to get the job started to establish his claim, then hit each worksite enough during the week for the client to see some progress. He dealt with any complaints and frustrations by assigning blame elsewhere and making more promises he knew were impossible to keep. Eventually, the job would be finished, and Henry would be paid in full, but by that time, clients were so tired of the process, they were glad to see Henry go. Not that he cared. After all, there was plenty of work and plenty of customers for the person who kept his eye on the big picture. When Henry paid his crews, he usually shorted them, adding the curt explanation that they had not completed the job to his satisfaction. After all, he knew, most of them were illegals. To whom would they complain? Henry awoke with a start in the middle of another bad dream. Bad dreams were all he had anymore, the product, Henry assumed, of a lack of sleep. Checking his watch as he hurried out the door of the big Chevy, the young businessman saw that it was almost 8 o'clock. The crew should have started an hour ago. Henry strode purposefully across the parking lot to where an 18-wheeler sat loaded with palm trees. Several workers were standing around with shovels in their hands, while one tinkered with a tractor that was not yet running. Henry cursed loudly, and the crew looked his way. "What are you people doing?" he screamed. "These trees should have already been unloaded. You aren't being paid to stand around. Two of you stay here. The rest of you, dig the mark holes." He cursed again as the workers scattered. By mid-morning, the trees were unloaded, and 11 workers, men and women, were spread across the property, feverishly and fearfully doing their jobs. Henry divided his time between haranguing the crews and dealing with his other neglected clients on the cell phone. The only calls he didn't answer were the ones from his wife. He was simply too busy and knew she would understand. Walking to the far corner of the property, Henry began to track the irrigation lines from the well. "Hey!" he called to the workers ahead of him. "Don't take all day trenching the lines so deep. Just get them covered with sand. 5 inches is as good as 15. "Sir?" came a voice from behind Henry. "What?" Henry answered without turning around. "Sir, if we don't bury the lines deeply, the wind will have them all uncovered in less than a month." "We won't be here in a month." "No, sir, we won't," the voice responded. "Only thing left here for everyone to see will be a bunch of uncovered irrigation lines, and your reputation." In a fury, Henry wheeled on whoever had dared to speak to him that way. "Who in the hell do you think—" He froze, seeing an old man in front of him, with the bluest eyes he had ever encountered. The crystalline gaze seemed to hold Henry in place, and for a moment the young man felt as though he might pass out. Regaining a degree of composure, Henry managed to croak, "Do you work for me?"
"I always have," the old man replied with a smile.
It seemed an odd answer from someone whom Henry was certain he had never seen. Yet, in another way, the old man was vaguely familiar. All the anger drained from Henry in an instant. In its place was an overwhelming sense of confusion.
"Tell me your name again." "Jones, and I know you prefer to be called Mr. Warren, but just for today, may I address you as a friend?"
Henry nodded dumbly. Was he getting sick? He wondered. He felt lightheaded, aware of a strange presence in this old man, manifested from his eyes, that took Henry's focus from everything but his face and the sound of his voice.
"Let's move to the shade, okay?"
Jones suggested, motioning to a large oak tree nearby.
"I want to ask you a couple of questions."
"But the work—"
Henry gestured feebly toward the crews and their frantic activity.
"The work will get done," Jones said, peering across the property. "But this is an important day for you, and we need to talk."
The old man moved the battered suitcase he held to his opposite hand and reached up to drape his arm across Henry's shoulders, guiding him gently to the relative privacy of the oak. Henry, for his part, did not want to go, did not know why he was going, but he walked in step with the old man without a word of disagreement.
"Sit here," Jones said, as Henry obligingly eased himself to the ground. "Can I get you some water?"
Henry shook his head. It was as if he were emerging from a fog. Henry's brain was firing in several different directions at once. "I am so tired. I followed this old man over here to... What am I supposed to do? I'm here to talk? About what?"
"Young man?"
Henry looked at Jones, who had lain the suitcase on its side and settled cross-legged on top of it, directly in front of him.
"Young man, do you hear me?"
"Yes, sir," he answered, wondering as he spoke why the old man was talking so loudly. His voice seemed to drown out the sounds of traffic on the road and the machinery on the property behind him.
"Yes, sir," he said again. "I can hear you."
Suddenly, Henry felt a wave of panic wash over him. "What is happening? Who is this man? Am I sick? Why can't I get up?" Just as quickly, Jones placed his hand on Henry's arm, and the younger man felt tension leave his body in a rush. "Who are you?" Henry asked somewhat fearfully. "What do you want from me?" Jones released Henry's arm and patted it a couple of times before pulling away.
"I am here to deliver some bad news," he answered. Then, leaning forward, Jones said, "Soon you will be dead."
Henry was already in such a state that his physical reaction was minimal, though everything inside him both screamed and scrambled to leave this man in this place. Instead, he whispered, "I don't understand."
"Life is a breath, a passing breeze, a blade of grass, green and vibrant for a time, only to wither, die, and disappear. Soon you will be dead. And after the funeral, Henry Warren's friends and family will gather to eat fried chicken and banana pudding. They will say the same things about him that they say about any other person for whom they didn't really care. Why? Because life is like a game of Monopoly. You may own hotels on Boardwalk, or you may be renting on Baltic Avenue, but in the end it all goes back in the box. The next generation will be getting out all your stuff and playing with it or fighting over it. Son, I've heard you many times refer to the big picture, but you need to hear from me now that the big picture you have in your head is leading you to a desperate life of hurt and darkness." As Henry listened, the fog in his brain lifted. Though he seemed unable to tear his eyes from the old man's own, he was hearing and comprehending every word Jones spoke. "You said that soon I would be dead," Henry started carefully. "Merely an attention-getter," Jones replied. "But an interesting perspective on life, wouldn't you agree? And no less than an absolute fact in your case than in the lives of everyone around you." Jones waved his hand, taking in all the people in his view. "They will all be dead soon, too. In fact," he added with a twinkle in his eye, "in dog years, most of them are already dead."
Henry shook his head as if to clear it.
"What are we talking about here? I still don't understand."
"I know you don't," Jones said with a gentle smile. "Let's see if we can't clear some things up."
He paused for a moment, then asked,
"Have you ever heard the saying, 'Don't sweat the small stuff'?"
"Yes," Henry responded.
"Well," Jones said, "I'm here to tell you that you'd better. See, the small stuff is what makes up the larger picture of our lives. Many people are like you, young man, but their perspective is distorted. They ignore small stuff, claiming to have an eye on the bigger picture, never understanding that the bigger picture is composed of nothing more than, are you ready? Small stuff." "Have you ever been bitten by an elephant?" the old man asked. Henry shook his head. "How about a mosquito?" Jones offered.
"Of course," Henry answered.
"You see what I mean?" Jones said, reaching out to cuff Henry on the shoulder. "It's the small stuff that'll get you."
Henry smiled in spite of himself. "A few years ago," Jones said, leaning back onto his elbows, "a squirrel climbed onto the Metro North Railroad power lines near New York City. He set off an electrical surge which weakened an overhead bracket. The bracket allowed a wire to dangle toward the tracks. The wire tangled in a train that tore down all the lines. As a result, 47,000 commuters were stranded in Manhattan for hours that evening. And I'll bet it wasn't even a big squirrel." "Remember the Hubble Space Telescope?" Jones continued. "It was conceived in 1946 and cost $2.5 billion to produce. Yet when it was launched into orbit, NASA discovered that a particular lens had been ground to 1/1,000th of an inch less than it should have been. That little thing, until it was repaired by astronauts, rendered the most expensive telescope in history no better than a good one on the ground." Jones watched Henry carefully to be certain he was listening. "My point, young man, at least for the beginning of our discussion, is that you'd be wise to sweat the small stuff. Little things do matter. Take Napoleon, for instance. A tiny part of the battle became immensely important to Napoleon when he defeated Wellington at Waterloo." Henry frowned. "But Napoleon didn't win at Waterloo," he said. "It was his greatest defeat." "Are you sure?" Jones asked. "Yes, absolutely." Jones nodded in concession. "You are correct, young man. On the 18th of June, 1815, Napoleon did indeed suffer his greatest defeat, an unmitigated disaster, at Waterloo. But that was only after he won." Jones chortled at the skeptical look on Henry's face and said, "Here is the story that very few know. Napoleon had brilliantly outmaneuvered Wellington's 77,000 men. This in addition to the more than 100,000 Prussians nearby. Together, those armies easily outnumbered Napoleon's 76,000. But when he got between them, Napoleon prevented the two from combining. He had already beaten the Prussians 2 days before, so he detached a part of his force to hold them at bay, while pointing the rest of his army toward Wellington and the British. Napoleon began the battle at a bit after 11 in the morning with an artillery barrage and an initial assault against the British right flank, pushing back and forth most of the day. At one point, Napoleon watched from a hillside as his troops pushed past Wellington's lines, capturing almost all of the 160 British cannons." Jones stopped his story and asked, "Have you ever seen one of those cannons up close?" "Yes," Henry answered. "A muzzle-loading cannon, right?" "Correct. The cannons were packed with black gunpowder, wadding in a projectile of some sort. The touch-hole of the cannon was then contacted with a flaming torch, which ignited the powder and fired the cannon. Do you follow me?" "Yes," Henry responded, unsure of just what he was supposed to follow. Jones continued, "It was customary in those days for several of the troops to carry small metal rods, nails, with them in the event that they overran the enemy's guns. The metal rods were then hammered into the cannon's touch hole, rendering it useless. When Napoleon's men overran Wellington's position and his cannons, it became immediately apparent that there were no spikes among his troops. As Napoleon screamed from the hilltops for the cannons to be destroyed, he watched Wellington's men retake the guns and turn them on their attackers. Napoleon was defeated, and all for a lack of a fistful of nails."
"I have never heard that story," Henry said.
"But what are you trying to tell me?"
"That your big picture will never be a masterpiece if you ignore the tiny brushstrokes. You are trying so hard to be successful that true success is eluding you. What pictures come into your mind when I say success? Quickly, tell me."
"Well," Henry started,
A house? A big house? Nice cars? Vacations? An expensive watch? Jewelry for my wife? A boat? Maybe several?
And now, Jones butted in before Henry could go any further, what comes to mind when I say successful life?
Henry didn't immediately answer, but finally, with a shaken look, he answered, my wife, my unborn child, it's a boy, you know.
Jones nodded. I know.
Keep going, he said.
Time to spend with my family? Good friends? People in whose lives I've made a difference? A positive difference?
Jones interrupted and watched as Henry's face whitened.
I have a feeling you've already made a difference in a few lives.
That's probably true, Henry acknowledged with shame.
No probably about it, young man, Jones said. You are like many people, Jones told him. One step away from a cliff you could avoid if you'd just take your blindfold off. Financially, physically, emotionally. In almost every area of your life, you are chasing success, yet bullying toward disaster. And so far, I'm one of only two people who care enough to tell you. The other one, at this point, is still your wife, but you won't listen to her. You won't even answer her calls.
Henry looked hard at the old man.
How do you know that? Am I wrong?
Receiving no reply, Jones looked toward the workers.
Can you tell me their names?
He asked. Henry shook his head. Jones pointed out the three closest, who were on their hands and knees, laying irrigation in the blazing sun.
Walter, Ramon, and Juanita. Walter is a grandfather. He has a son named William, who is an engineer with a wife and two children of their own. They lived in Detroit, but William was laid off a year ago. Soon after, one of the kids got sick. Now that family is back with Walter and his wife.
Jones turned, scanning the property, his hands shading his eyes. He gestured toward a younger man digging a hole for a palm.
There's William. He works on your crew, too. Ramon and Juanita are not yet parents, though they'd like to be. They're actually the same age as you, young man, and your wife. Juanita had a miscarriage 4 days ago, on Saturday. Do you remember what you told Ramon on Monday morning?
Well, he didn't tell me that.
You told him that if his wife wasn't on the job that afternoon, they'd both be fired.
Jones held Henry's gaze for a moment, then looked around again.
Martin is the boy working the hose,
Jones said, nodding in the boy's direction.
He is 16. This is his first job. His father owns half the real estate in this town. He wanted his son to get his own job and make his own way this summer. He could have worked at any number of businesses his father owns, but here he is. Martin has told his father what it's like to work for you. But so far, his father has encouraged him not to quit. I think his father is using you as an example for his son. He knows Martin will also be responsible for quite a few employees in the future. And as long as you don't hit the boy, I think his father will keep him here. But young man?
Henry's eyes flickered up.
I don't think you'll be getting any glowing references from anyone associated with Martin's family. The three young fellas over there.
Henry turned to follow Jones' pointing finger.
They're with the palm, Hugo, Ricardo, and Mario. They're from a small town south of the Texas border. Their father's dead. Their mother is sick. Sick with what? They don't have the money to find out. They have a sister who is 15 and dreams of one day going to college. They came across the border a month ago and hitched a ride here. Less chance of getting caught in this area, they think.
Jones paused, then added,
I'm not saying what they did was right. I'm just telling you who they are. Shirley and Letha are mother and daughter. They're at the water cooler watching you. They look scared to death, don't they? Like you might yell at them for stopping for a drink.
Jones waited to see if Henry would say something, but the younger man merely hung his head.
Something is wrong with Letha, Jones went on after a moment. She's almost 30, but has the mind of a 12-year-old. Her husband left years ago. Shirley could qualify for any number of government programs, but she's simply too proud. This is only one of three jobs she holds down.
Fred is the skinny guy holding the ditch digger. He's 50 and working a couple of jobs himself. He lives in an apartment with his mother, a good man, by all accounts, but devoid of hope. He lost it years ago. Fred probably doesn't work as hard as he could or as he should. Is that why you shorted him $50 last week?
Jones lowered his head in order to make eye contact with Henry, who was staring at the ground. I paid him what he deserved, Henry offered feebly.
That's probably true, Jones agreed.
Then the old man's face hardened.
What about you, young man? He asked flatly. Would you like to get what you deserve?
Jones let that question hang in the air for a moment, then sighed, shook his head, and said,
Me? I surely don't want what I deserve. I'm hoping for mercy, not justice.
These lives, these spirits, Walter and William, Shirley, Letha, Ramon, Juanita, and the rest, are just as precious to the one who made them as your unborn son is to you. For a time the two sat quietly, alone at the crossroad that Henry Warren's life had just reached. The old man was waiting and watching, as he had with so many others, for evidence of a decision. In the old man's experience, the decision to turn one's life in a different direction rarely arrived with fireworks and marching bands. Often the decision came with tears and regret. Then, almost impossibly, the power of forgiveness would fill an unseen void, allowing a new day's optimism and a sense of purpose to take hold and point that life in a new direction.
My life is a mess, Henry said softly.
Yes, it is, Jones agreed, but only up to this moment.
The younger man looked up. What do you mean?
I mean that you can change. Now, you can change how you do business, how you treat your family, and how you treat the people whose working lives have been entrusted to you. You can change how you treat them right now.
Jones peered carefully into the eyes of the younger man as he continued.
Most people think it takes a long time to change. It doesn't. Change is immediate. Instantaneous. It may take a long time to decide to change, but change happens in a heartbeat.
Then I will change, Henry said. I mean, I am changed.
You understand, of course, Jones said, that it might take a while for your reputation to catch up to the change you have already made?
Henry nodded.
Most folks will be in that deciding to change mode in their opinions about you for some time yet. But the change you have made will show evidence of a different man, and sooner or later others will change their feelings about you as well. One quick question, Jones said with an obvious lightening of the mood. And to complete the change in all areas of your life, you will need to understand the answer. Are you ready?
Okay,
Henry said warily.
5 seagulls are sitting on a dock. One of them decides to fly away. How many seagulls are left?
Well,
4. No, Jones responded. There are still 5. Deciding to fly away and actually flying away are 2 very different things. Listen carefully to me. Despite popular belief to the contrary, there is absolutely no power in intention. The seagull may intend to fly away, may decide to do so, may talk with the other seagulls about how wonderful it is to fly, but until the seagull flaps his wings and takes to the air, he is still on the dock. There is no difference between that gull and all the others. Likewise, there is no difference in the person who intends to do things differently and the one who never thinks about doing it in the first place. Have you ever considered how often we judge ourselves by our intentions, while we judge others by their actions?
Yet intention without action is an insult to those who expect the best from you. I intended to bring you flowers, but I didn't. I meant to finish this work on time. I was going to be there for your birthday.
Henry felt overwhelmed but determined. I get it, I think. Now, what do I do first?
If you have changed, Jones said, show evidence of it.
He pointed to the cell phone on Henry's belt and smiled.
First, call your wife. The rest you'll figure out.
Henry unclipped the phone, looked at Jones, and asked,
Right now?
Right now,
the old man said as he stood and stretched. Henry dialed the familiar number and waited for his wife to answer. When she did, his words came in a rush.
Honey, I'm so sorry for so many things. I promise things will be better. I will be better. I know I sound crazy right now, but we need to talk when I get home. I met a guy, and I want you to say hello. Hang on just a minute.
Henry looked up. He turned around, but the old man was gone. Baffled, Henry did a complete 360, scanning the sight for a glimpse of old Jones, but he was nowhere to be seen. But in that brief moment of confusion, Henry had no way of knowing that Jones was not through with him yet. Chapter 8. Several days had passed since his conversation with the strange old man, and Henry Warren was discouraged. What he had thought would be a relatively smooth process of converting people to the new Henry was anything but. He had tried to apologize to everyone he had openly offended with little success. One man had taken the opportunity to tell Henry just what he thought of him and his apology. Even Henry's wife was having a hard time adjusting. As for Henry, determination had never been a problem for him. He remained convinced that something had happened to him that day with Jones under the oak tree. He was truly a different man, he believed. Unfortunately, no one seemed willing to give him the benefit of the doubt. On this particular morning, Henry was on his hands and knees finishing the last of the irrigation so that the sod could be laid at the condominium's entrance. He was working beside Ramon and had insisted that Juanita rest in his truck during the heat of the day.
It is Thursday, Ramon thought. He has been like this since Monday when Garcia left. And Mr. Warren has ordered Juanita to rest?
Neither Ramon nor Juanita understood exactly what was happening, but they had never seen Henry actually work with them either. All they had known from this man had been curses and threats. Now this? And who was the old man Ricardo and Hugo had told him was named Garcia? What did he have to do with all this?
"You sure are burying those lines awfully deep,"
a familiar voice said. Henry looked up, almost afraid to hope. But sure enough, there he was.
"Jones!" he said excitedly as he scrambled to his feet. "Man, I am glad to see you. And by the way, we are burying them deeper than I told the developer we would."
"Good for you," the old man said, obviously pleased.
"Can you spare a minute?" Henry asked. "I didn't know how to reach you, and, well, I need to talk."
"Sure," Jones said. "I thought you might have a few questions by now."
Henry patted Ramon on the back with a smile and pointed him toward his wife and the water cooler. "Break," he said.
"Good work, Ramon. Take 15 minutes, okay?"
Jones almost laughed out loud at the combination of happiness and confusion coming together on Ramon's face as he tried to understand this new boss. To Henry, Jones motioned toward the shade of the oak tree and said,
"Our tree?"
"Fine," Henry agreed and reached for the old man's suitcase. "Let me carry that for you."
"No, no," Jones said, laughing as he swung it out of Henry's reach. "I'm old. Don't make me out to be feeble, too."
And he turned and trudged purposefully toward their meeting room under the tree. Henry followed. As they settled on the ground, Henry couldn't have been happier. He was thrilled that the old man had shown up again. It was almost a physical change he noticed in himself when Jones was around. But soon Henry grew somber as he remembered what he wanted to say. Jones didn't miss Henry's change of expression.
"How are you doing?" Jones asked.
"Good, fine," Henry answered, then scrunched up his face. "Or not good. I don't really know."
"Tell me," Jones urged. "I have apologized to several,
Actually, quite a few people. My wife first, of course, some suppliers and developers. All my crew here, every one of them, Jones. But they don't seem to be okay with me. There's still a distance, even with my wife. Heck, especially with my wife. You know, she's 7 months pregnant. I'd like to get this settled before the baby is born.